This is the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, episode 52. Welcome to the Hack Your Wealth Podcast, where we teach wealth building hacks for lawyers, engineers, and MBAs. I'm your host, Andrew Chen. All right, thanks so much again for tuning into the podcast. For today's episode, I invited another guest to come and share their tips and strategies and insights with us. So before we jump into that, as always, I want to invite you to join the private Hack Your Wealth Facebook group. You can access that at hackyourwealth.com/FB. Definitely encourage you to join us there. It is a place for us to connect, have a two-way dialogue. I'm in there every single day, often multiple times a day, and I try to respond to every question and comment there. And it's a place where people can ask about financial independence, early retirement, tax strategies, real estate investing, side business income, online income, career transitions, career advice, or just ask about whatever's on their mind related to personal finance or career-related issues. Definitely encourage you to check that out. It's a great, friendly, helpful group of people, and we would love to have you there. Again, hackyourwealth.com/FB. All right, let's jump in to today's interview. My guest today is Dr. Chirag Shamazian. Chirag is a college admissions expert and founder of Shamazian Academic Consulting, a college and graduate school admissions consultancy. His company has coached thousands of students to successful admission at the most elite colleges in the country. Think Ivy League in U.S. News Top 10. He's a graduate of Cornell University and received his PhD in clinical psychology from UCLA, and he's been featured in the Washington Post, U.S. News, and NBC, among other publications. Chirag, thanks so much for joining us today to share insights and wisdom with our parents and students about how to win admission to elite universities. Very excited to be talking
with
you,
Andrew.
About this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Cool. Awesome. So, you know, we did a really insightful interview not too long ago about how to win college scholarships. So that you can attend school for free. But briefly, for folks who may not have caught that episode, just to orient themselves, how did you get into the business of university admissions consulting?
Yeah, so organically, honestly. So I went to a high school, Andrew, where we had very little college admission support. I grew up in LA and I went to a very small Armenian school. And, you know, success there was essentially defined as you get into UCLA, which is a terrific school. I love UCLA, don't get me wrong. But I always wanted something different. And, you know, I set out to learn what it takes to get into, you know, Ivy Leagues and other top 10s and so on. And I had, you know, a lot of success on the college admission side back when I was a senior in high school. I don't want to date myself too much. But, you know, along the way, people just kept asking me questions. You know, how did you get into such and such school? Or how did you, you know, get so many scholarships? And all this stuff. And so I started helping people who were coming to me and they started having a lot of success. And it sort of snowballed from there, you know, word of mouth increased and all this good stuff. And over the years, people just kept coming. And over after some time, you know, it just sort of grew to a place where I was like, you know, there's something here and I think I can support more people. And that's basically the genesis of it. I certainly didn't go into helping people thinking it would become a certain business or anything of that sort. But students were having a lot of success. I love doing this work. It's such a meaningful thing to, you know, help students achieve their academic and career goals. And here I am today chatting with you.
Awesome. Okay, so let me just dive right in here and sort of get to the heart of it. You know, most colleges are not that competitive to get into. It's only at the top national universities that the competition really heats up. And with the Ivy League or the U.S. News top 10 to 15 universities or national liberal arts colleges like Amherst or Williams, then the competition gets severe. Yeah. What are the biggest myths and misconceptions that folks may have when it comes to applying for and winning admission to top colleges? Let's say we're just focusing on undergrad here.
Yeah. First off, that's such a salient point, Andrew, about how, you know, there are so many thousands of colleges in this country and many of them, perhaps the majority of them have, you know, over 50% success, you know, acceptance rates. And so in America, it's not hard for most people to get into a college. The question is, how do you get to certain colleges that are considered to be, you know, quote unquote, elite or at the top? And these schools have, you know, tiny acceptance rates, oftentimes below 10%, even below 5% at some of the most elite schools. And so at that stage, you know, at that level, it stops being so much about, you know, just grades and test scores. where a lot of people focus, but these other factors as well. So, you know, that I think segues really nicely into the myth, like one of the first myths, which is, you know, so long as you get great grades and great test scores, you're set. Okay. Especially at the elite schools, most of the applicants will have incredible grades and incredible test scores. So these colleges at the top, they can fill their entire student body with students who get near perfect test scores probably several times over, right? So if a school has a freshman class of, you know, 2,000-3,000 students, they can probably, if they pick the whole other set of 2,000-3,000 students, they can probably still get a pool comprising students with near perfect scores, right? So that's how competitive it is. So I think of grades and test scores as a necessary, but not sufficient piece of the admissions puzzle, right? So you have to have high grades and test scores, but it doesn't just stop there, which then begs the question, well, if it's necessary, but not sufficient, how do you sort of get over that hump, right? And this is really where these other factors that are heavily related with your social, with your extracurricular activities, as well as your, you know, personal statements and recommendations, letters, etc. That's really how you differentiate yourself from the applicant pool. So if an admissions committee member sees, you know, two applications from students with essentially the same stats, they're going to differentiate those students based on their extracurricular profile and, you know, recommendation letters and personal statements and things of that nature. So it's really the case that you have to develop an extracurricular profile that is very distinct from the rest of the applicant pool. There's a big myth that you should have to be a jack of all trades, or you have to be quote unquote well-rounded, you know, join all of these different clubs and be the president of the club and things of this nature, which used to work maybe 20 years ago, certainly 30 years ago. But as people caught on and everyone was joining club after club after club and sort of resume stacking and activity stacking, colleges wisened up to this and they said, well, I can't differentiate these students anymore. So I want to admit students who have achieved at an extremely high level in one or two areas, which some people call a spike, other people call a specialty, and essentially went really, really deep into those areas. So that's a huge factor in elite admissions.
Got it. So, you know, it's interesting that that you mentioned that admissions committees really, they're not any longer really looking for well-rounded students, even though they are actively trying to assemble a well-rounded class, and they'd rather have a class that consists of students who are very high achieving at the, you know, they're the each the best or near the top of their field. Maybe it's award-winning writers or nationally recognized science prodigies, maybe Olympic athletes, critically acclaimed musicians, math whizzes or whatever. Even if those students are not individually well-rounded, they'd rather have those students more than your traditional well-rounded students who took a lot of AP classes, joined a bunch of clubs, did volunteer work at the hospital, played the piano. So yeah, they want to admit these specialists who have this cohesive, integrated academic extracurricular story that's built around like one or two core interests or passions that are built up over many years, rather than students who splinter their time in different directions. And so I was curious if maybe you could comment a little bit on what you have seen in terms of this trend, maybe even in your own consulting practice, you know, anonymized, of course, but just so sure, folks can really understand, like, what are the markers for how an admissions committee is actually looking for differentiation in an applicant?
Sure. I'm actually, I'm really excited to talk about this, about examples. I actually want to take a step back and talk about certain related myths related to what you just mentioned. So it is true that the, you know, the highest tier schools look for students who are truly exceptional, right? And, you know, the Stanfords and Harvards of the world, they do have people who, you know, are Olympians or science prodigies or, I don't know, the next Mozart or whatever the case might be. However, not everyone who attends those schools is, you know, exceptional at that level, right? So the reason I bring this up, because a lot of students and parents, they look at these examples of, you know, truly, truly elite students in their areas and, you know, arguably edge cases, and they think, I'll never be like them. I'm not, you know, I know I'm smart. I'm not in the, you know, I'm not the next Einstein. I'm not Michael Phelps. I'm not any of these, you know, highly, highly, highly exceptional people in whatever field I've chosen. And so they think, well, I'm not going to get it anyway. Or they might say, I'm also not a legacy. You know, I don't have connections. I don't have the hookup or whatever it is that they're thinking. So I bring that up because I want to encourage students and parents alike to think, okay, how can I elevate my extracurricular profile so that whatever niche I chose, I can be viewed as a student of that caliber. Okay. I think it's easy for us to look at, you know, Olympians or National Science Award winners because those are clear achievements. They're tangible. They're like, in some ways, they're like stats, right? When you get a 1580 on the SAT, that's quantifiable. Going to the Olympics is like a clear achievement. Sometimes when there isn't, in your chosen area, if there isn't some clear distinction like that, you think it wasn't as special, right? So sometimes parents ask me, can, you know, a quote unquote normal kid like mine, who's not an Olympian, can they also get into these schools? And the answer is yes. The question is, how do you make that happen? Hmm. Right. And so essentially you have to get very, very strict about how you use your time. Okay. Most students will go to high school, they'll look around and they'll think, there's this opportunity, there's that opportunity, Susan's doing this, Chen is doing that, you know, Priya's doing this other thing, and I feel like I'm falling behind if I don't, you know, follow suit. Or they'll say, you know, so-and-so got into Yale, what did they do? And they basically will work backwards and try to recreate the same exact profile. But that's not how this works. There are two questions every student needs to solve when they are, you know, when they're going for this. Well, actually, there are sort of two categories within these extracurricular spikes. Number one is the highest level achievement in your craft. That's sort of the math whiz, science prodigy, you know, Olympian sort of category, right? Be the absolute best of the best in some, you know, competitive space. The risk in that is, what it's the point whatever percent of students in that space will end up, you know, achieving at that level. So we don't remember as much the students who are even in the 97th, 98th percentile, right? A good test for this is, you know, if I ask somebody who's the best basketball player of all time, you know, and they'll say Michael Jordan or LeBron James, right? Depending on what generation you are, there's that difference. If I said, who's the second best? They might say the other person they just didn't name. The third. If I said, who's the seventh best? Now they're like, all right, I got to like think about it. And you don't ascribe the same level of specialness to that. And so the risk in, you know, joining some very crowded space, competitive space, is it's very hard to become the Michael Jordan or, you know, whichever athlete you like, Megan Rapinoe or whatever the case might be. And so then there is this other category of, okay, if I'm not at that level, if I'm not the next Mozart, how do I approach this? Two questions to ask yourself. Number one is, what community or population do I want to serve? Number two is, what problem do I want to solve? Okay. And so when we think about examples, a lot of these examples are born of students who achieved things, you know, with very clear focus, because they went out to solve a problem. So for instance, you know, there might be a student who says, I want to solve, you know, help work on food insecurity in, you know, for people in the inner city, because I know there are food deserts and there aren't, you know, great supermarkets with fresh produce nearby, or there are a bunch of fast food options or whatever. And so they might end up, you know, I've seen students who have set up an urban farm in the inner city, right? And so they'll set up a network of urban farms and they'll plant, you know, nutritious food, and they'll teach people how to cook it. And they'll, you know, recruit physicians to give talks on proper nutrition and how to balance your diet and all these kinds of things, and really collaborate with communities. Or there might be a student who has a personal health difficulty. Maybe they, you know, can't see so well, or they have like a very rare condition and they're not exactly sure, you know, how they're going to, you know, doctors aren't sure how they're going to treat it. There might be some experimental things, sometimes not, but they start fiddling with different ways to solve this issue. You know, I recently heard of students who, you know, had developed a patent, you know, or had received a patent for this kind of thing. And, you know, that person, in retrospect, we think, Well, that person's like the Olympian. It's just in another niche, but it's not like they started with some extraordinary head start, right? They just had a problem and they, you know, really focused on solving that problem for themselves and for the community of people who shared the same problem, right? So these are just some examples, and you know, we can go on and on about it, but it always boils down to, who do you want to serve? What problem do you want to solve? And if you get really focused about that and sort of set aside all these low yield, easy to participate in activities, you can have tremendous success.
So if you, I guess, reach that insight early in life, like what community you want to serve, what problem you want to solve, you have, you know, arguably just a longer runway to start developing the evidence and track record of results. And that sounds like is really the crucial element to a successful application, maybe even the most important factor, at least at the elite level. And so you have this, essentially this head start, you can clock your 10,000 hours on it earlier and faster, so to speak. And that's almost certainly going to propel you farther than a student who discovers their passion, say, only in their 20s or later in life. How would you advise a student who honestly and genuinely just doesn't know what they're interested in yet or what they want to do yet? Maybe they just haven't found their thing and aren't ready to devote themselves to just one or two things to the exclusion of all else. Because it's hard for anyone, let alone a young teenager, to really know what they might be distinctive at or even world-class at, even if it's in a more niche area and where their talents might be. So I would love to kind of get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. You know, another important thing to note here is, you know, these schools that are so competitive and, you know, sort of reserved for students with exceptional achievements, the word exceptional is very important, right? They are the exceptions. When people are like, well, I just want to like, I can't achieve at that level. Well, these schools are looking for those students. So, you know, we have to think about how to do it rather, because if you put in your head that I'm not at that level, I won't be at that level, you won't try. And then it'll be like, see, I knew it this whole time. It's reserved for other people who aren't like me or whatever. But going directly to your point, I think one of the most dangerous things when it comes to college admissions, and I hear this from parents and students alike, is that they first have to find their passion before they start doing things. So dangerous. People might be surprised when they listen to this, like, why is finding your passion dangerous? Because it's not like you wake up one day and a light bulb goes off and you're like, aha, passion. I know it now. I will devote the next 4 years of high school and the next 40 years of my life to this thing because I was walking down the street and it finally hit me. Okay. And at the same time, we oftentimes look at people's achievement and we think that we need to get there really quickly, or that's how it's done. I mean, you know this, you know, you started a podcast, you know, I've started this organization. We weren't where we are now from day one. We see other people in, you know, the position we hope to be some point, but it's not an overnight kind of thing. So to think like, once I have, I need to discover my passion, and B, once I have my passion in 2 months, I'll be golden. You know, I'll have it all figured out. I'll have the patent. I'll have the whatever. It's not that way. You have to decide, like I said, whom you want to serve and what issues you want to work on, and begin. You have to begin, because, you know, you might begin working on, you know, you might have thought initially, you know what, I like, you know, I'm working on this urban farm, you know, going back to that example. And I thought what I really wanted to do was to, you know, plant these fruit and vegetable gardens all over the city, do this nutrition course and all that kind of stuff. But then while studying like how, like which plants grow in which environments, and I got really into botany. And so I actually ended up like reaching out to a local university professor. And I, you know, by the time I was done with high school, I first authored 3 papers on botany, you know. If the student had said, I'm just going to wait until it hits me, botany may have never hit them. So you have to make an educated guess based on the information you have at the moment you're making the decision, and then go for it. And if you start something, you're not married to it. if you're like, I'm going to go volunteer at the local nursing home, and because I'm interested in working with the elderly population and making sure that they, you know, they have more social connection, right? Like, go. And if you realize after putting some time into it that it's actually not what you're interested in, that's okay, right? But not trying because you're like, I don't know if I want to devote 4 years to the nursing home, then you're not really going to get anywhere. So make the best guess based on the information you have at that moment and pivot as needed. It's not that different from, you know, a startup company where you have to start with what your hunch is and see how things go. And maybe, you know, you reach certain forks in the road and take different directions.
At the risk of sounding too obvious, what are the kinds of things that a student can do that, or that they can just reflect on for themselves that would be likely to indicate an emerging interest or curiosity? Basically, how can a student do this self-evaluation when they're at the moment of decision?
Yeah. What do they spend their time on when they're bored or when they have the time? Who do they like spending time? What do they like to read about? What do they think about? What subjects do they most enjoy in school? You know, if they were asked to volunteer and they had, you know, five choices in their community, which one did they choose and why? Right? It's a big misconception that there are certain activities in certain arenas that are quote unquote serious enough, right? Whereas others aren't. For instance, if, you know, someone, the number of times, Andrew, I've heard like, well, you know, she likes playing video games, but anyway, you know, I'm trying to think of something she could do for extracurriculars. I'm like, how good is she at video games? Does she like to code video games? Does she like, are there internship opportunities available to her? I don't know. Is she an e-game, you know, sort of expert or something like that? So in other words, like it's dangerous to downplay an interest because you don't think that's a serious enough one. You know, if a parent has a student who is a budding science prodigy, they'll usually be like, yeah, pursue it, because they can see there are awards, there are contests, there are all these kinds of things. So, but then if it's like this person, you know, he likes to draw. Because it's harder to, you know, it's harder to get involved in certain competitions on the national level and all this kind of stuff, they sort of downplay it. But then I always ask students, what about drawing do you like? Well, it allows me to really escape. Okay. Who do you think needs an escape? Well, I feel like, you know, there are people in the, you know, in hospice care who, you know, for whom I want to help improve, you know, quality of life. Okay. How can we take this interest and, you know, take it to a local hospice and then, you know, make sure that it's improving quality of life? You know, is this like a weekly thing that you begin doing? Okay. And then you go and you see, yeah, you know what? It is something that I really enjoy. Okay. Now you go to the second one in your community and the third one. Now you recruit your friends from high school and you start a whole network. You start in different cities and so on. Now, if someone had said, I like art because I, you know, I just want to, you know, produce the best art possible, you would go down a different path versus if you like the calming effect of it. Or maybe you like working with like kids with disabilities or something like that. So ask yourself always, what about this do I like? And that will take you in a million different directions. Ask yourself at every stage.
Do you ever, or have you ever seen students where the interest is, I guess it just leads to a dead end?
No. I mean, it might lead them to a dead end, but that doesn't mean that it's an objective dead end. Like there are no possibilities, right? So in other words, just because you feel stuck doesn't mean you are, you know?
That's good insight. Okay, so, you know, college applications, they really only or most predominantly look at your high school record onward. But by the time students actually start high school, the differences in accomplishment are already becoming apparent. And so everyone is coming in at different trajectories and velocities, even at 13, 14 years old. So I was just curious in what you just said, how far in advance in terms of years are the really like distinguished and competitive students, or the students who are on that track starting to develop the kind of interests or I won't use the word passions, but interests anyway, that can that look like they may blossom into eventually a compelling application profile, at least in your observation. What have you seen in terms of students you come across? And I realize I want to caveat that this might sound like it's bordering on parental or child rearing advice, but I'm just curious about your perspective here, since you've seen a lot of different profiles. You've seen a bit about how those students were brought up, who was successful, who wasn't, and probably have some pattern recognition on this by now.
Okay, so just for me to clarify the question so I don't misstep here, it's essentially what qualities I've seen in the student or what qualities I've seen in the fostering of that interest.
Like, how far in advance do you start to see these interests developing?
It's all over the map. You know, I'll have students who will reach out and, you know, parents will say, you know, ever since, you know, I'm an engineer, mom's an engineer, and, you know, they've just love building things and they love math. They've always loved math and this is what they want to do. They want to go into aeronautics or whatever the case might be, right? They'll have this level, like this clear interest in a certain area. And so there are students like that. There are other students who come to me in 10th grade and they say, I've been doing these different things. I'm not yet sure. I have some of these interests, but it's nowhere near, you know, it hasn't been, you know, developing over a decade, over 15 years or something like that. And so for those students, you just have to meet students wherever they at. I think that the students who, you know, one of the patterns I've observed is among students who, you know, achieve at a really high level in these areas is just encouragement from students, from teachers, from, you know, mentors like me, right? In other words, like not shooting down. How many times, Andrew, have we, you know, thought of ideas or have we seen people share ideas and for others, their immediate response is why something won't work, why something isn't good enough. And people mean well, you know. To be clear, it's not like people are trying to crush these students' spirits by saying, you know, whatever. But because they oftentimes don't see what the end goal is, or they don't see it as a quote-unquote serious enough thing, they won't promote it, right? And I think that every student has something that they can promote, even if it's not like an interest. Let's say it's not an interest where it's like they love botany or they love mechanical engineering or they love art or whatever. Maybe it's they have this tremendous quality about them. Like they can relate to anybody, you know? Okay. You can use those powers for a lot of good, right? How can maybe, you know, maybe you start a pen pal network or something like that. Or, you know, you begin volunteering with, you know, kids with disabilities and, you know, you do sort of big brother, big sister program in parts of town that don't have them. Or, you know, during this COVID season of life, when we're recording this, maybe there are students who, you know, don't have access to the same digital technologies that you have to be successful. And so you help, you know, take old electronics and deliver it to these people because all you want to do is help and you want to, you know, improve connectedness. Or maybe one big problem that schools haven't solved during this time is recess, you know? It's like the little things, right? Where it's like, yeah, we're thinking about how do we do math on Zoom and how do we do this and how do we do that? Well, what about like people's connections with their friends and all this kind of stuff, right? So there's always going to be something you can solve with the qualities that you have, but you have to get clear on the communities you want to serve. Without that, honestly, you're floating. You're just, you know, one idea is as good as the other and nothing will ever stick. You can always, you know, swipe right.
I like the analogy.
Left. I've never used, I don't know, but you know, one of those types.
For the parents, what are things that they could do to be more encouraging? And I just kind of think about like a lot of immigrant parents. They might be, for whatever reason, more instinctively like quote unquote shoot something down. Like, oh, you like posting YouTube videos and, you know, building your Instagram account. Like what? You know, like do something for real. Like, but how would you advise parents and folks who are in a position to encourage students to do that? What are mindsets or actions they can take?
Yeah. So that's a good, I think you said immigrant parents, right? Certainly my parents are immigrants and, you know, if there was YouTube back then and I was like, Dad, Mom, I'm going to start a channel, they'll be like, okay, yeah, no, you're not going to do that. So, you know, they would have shot that down for sure. So just because we don't know, I say we as in anyone who's unaware of how to take something to a high level and achieve at a high level, doesn't mean it's a silly idea. So if you're the type of parent who likes quantifiable things, who wants to know how good or their child's achievement or how strong their child's achievement is, start reading about it. If your child says, you know, I want to build this YouTube channel. I really feel like I can teach X, Y, and Z. Okay. The parent, it's your job to learn how someone can leverage those things, right? I mean, the obvious, like, you know, you can grow to a bunch of followers and you can start getting ad revenue and all this kind of stuff. But it might also lead to other opportunities. Maybe you lead, you know, you produce certain educational videos and now like school districts are using them or whatever the case might be. And think about these metrics, followers, revenue that you might then use to start a charity or whatever the case might be. So in other words, it's not like the avenue is what makes or breaks an activity. So like, let's say I went and I taught, you know, like an overused example. Let's say I played music for people at a nursing home, you know, like a classic old school, low level example. Okay. Parents would say, oh, wow, you know, they're giving back, devoted to service and stuff like that. If that same student, you know, made videos and they reach people, sometimes parents would think, oh, it's just like a YouTube video. They almost like devalue it because it's a video, whatever. But if they're taking that again and they're growing it and reaching more people, it's solving the same issue, which is building entertainment and relaxation and those things for people who could really benefit from it. Right. And then maybe you, like I said, you those resources that you get and now you start purchasing supplies for communities in need. And it just has this downstream effect. Or maybe you connect with another like great, like larger musician or a musician who has more followers and you do a collaboration with them. And all of a sudden now you're building a network of musicians that you know online and you've connected and you've turned it into something big. Maybe together you put together an online course for people who want to start learning how to play guitar. You take that and then you have art programs at schools. You see how the impact you want to make can be very much related to things you like to do. The medium matter. Right? It's just an avenue. It's not like YouTube isn't the activity. It's the means through to pursue it. And I think that's a huge, mindset shift, that I'd like to see in parents, you know, to not push aside an activity just because you have a bias against the medium. My parents think it's weird probably that I blog. They're like, what is that? You know, how do you actually use this to reach people or to, you know, all this kind of stuff.
That's really good advice there. So, you know, like you observed earlier, when you're doing something that has quantifiable achievement milestones, like, you know, math or science whiz or Olympic athlete, et cetera, the markers are clear. But some of these other things where you're basically developing your own accomplishment, so to speak, what are the markers or of the level of accomplishment or achievement that you have seen will tend to stand out and get the attention of an admissions committee and be a real differentiator? If you can like sort of describe the markers of that, be helpful.
Such a tough question. Asking what level do I have to reach in my niche, right? For it to be considered impressive, right? Is that a question?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. So, and by the way, please feel free to clarify if I'm going off in the wrong direction. But this goes back to the earlier point where, you know, let's say we did this channel about, you know, teaching guitar. What level do you have to reach for that to be equivalent to being the Olympic channel, right? In other words, it's very hard to, you know, by a certain peak. I'll give you a good one good metric. It's a very subjective metric, but I think it works. If you have to ask yourself, how the heck did he do that? You've made it. So super non-objective, super not viable, but it's a failed simulation effect. So there's a professor named Cal Newport who has a great book, How to Be a High School Superstar. I recommend parents who are interested in college planning and extra planning. And essentially it says, you know, if I can walk myself through the steps of student achieve this, then it's not that impressive. But if I can't recreate the path in my head and I'm stumped, impressive. Right? So the how the heck did he or how the heck did she do that? If you reach that level, great. Now, the thing is, because those things are hard to think through, a lot of times parents and students don't know how to begin, right? So they're like, how do you achieve something at that level? So they just, again, throw their hands up and say, my kid's not like that. And so I'm not going to do it. But times where you have to begin and do these pivots, because as you do this and you develop your movements, it be harder and harder to realize how that occurred or how to replicate that success.
Got it. I think I caught most of that. It was a little bit choppy, but I think I caught most of that.
Okay.
And I think that takeaway here is that if you can reasonably, look at that student and say, how did the heck did they achieve that? You've got good things going on there. But if it seems obvious for how to recreate that result, then maybe less impressive.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Okay. So someone born in a well-to-do family or in a large city will probably have more just opportunity than someone who grew up poor, or even middle class, small town, to academic programs, extracurricular opportunities, and just resources. If you're from a small town, you probably don't have the kind of gravity well of opportunities. If you grew up poor, you also probably don't have the same opportunities as somebody who grew up well-to-do. And, you know, I know college admissions committees, they try to take this into account by making sure that students who had access actually took advantage of the opportunities. And likewise, they give a bit of a boost to students who didn't. But doing that in a fair way is still subjective. So I was curious to get your thoughts on, you know, if you were a student who grew up lower income or from a small town with materially fewer opportunities, what are things that you can do proactively to overcome that? And how can these students develop their interests and show promise so they have the best chance of demonstrating their potential despite any life constraints they may have had?
Yeah. Terrific question. So every student is judged within their own context. Meaning, you know, the student who, I don't know, to use this stereotype, someone who grew up in New York City in a wealthy family who has all sorts of different opportunities versus someone who grew up in, against stereotype, like rural Louisiana, who, didn't come from doesn't come from a very wealthy family or something. Their access, their opportunities, their resources are different. So it's a very hard, you can't have a one-to-one compare. It's not an apples to apples comparison, right? Maybe they didn't go to a school that had the same number of AP exams off or AP courses offered, or they didn't have, people in their community don't get SAT prep, or maybe, you know, there are no elite summer programs at the local universities because there is no local university. And you have your parents' business that you work at over the summers. You don't go to Brown and do science research or something. So you're going to be judged within your own context. So let's example of, let's say you are the student who lives in Louisiana, okay? And, you know, your parents own, I don't know, choose a business, painting business. You know, they paint houses. And, you know, it's sort of different because they don't navigate online marketing, you know? And so you help, you know, set up their Yelp page, or you get them on Google Maps and you start using, you know, Page or something like that. And you keep your parents' business afloat, you know. That can be just as for a student to revive a business as it is to go into these pay-for-play types of summer programs and achieve at a high level. But then on top of that, it's all about how you leverage that experience and how you communicate that experience that helps you stand out, okay? So two people can have the same experience, but the way one writes about an experience can make all the difference. So let's say now there's a kid in rural Louisiana who has the painting business, and there's a student in, you know, way Northern California in a rural part of the state also help their parents' house. But then one of them just wrote exceptional materials for their essays, and they both have solid grades and all these kinds of things, good rec letters. And now one of them, you know, just writes an exceptional essay about this. They're going to have an advantage over that other student. So it's not only what you do with the situation you're in, but also how you communicate it, right? If you put together the greatest thing on earth, but no one knows about it, or you're not great at, you know, I don't know, marketing it or making it known, you're not going to reach the same heights as you otherwise would.
That's a really good segue. And I wanted to ask a little bit about your thoughts on, you know, writing the essay, the personal statement. What is the mindset that students should have when it comes to writing their personal statement? And do you have any practical advice for how to pick a personal statement topic, write it in a compelling way, even if you're not a great writer inherently?
Yeah.
And the kind of themes or self-reflection that might make for a compelling essay?
Yeah. Let's first talk about what you shouldn't do, which is just at your resume. And what's the most unique thing on this list? What does no one else have? And then all of a sudden you realize, well, I don't know what's unique enough, right? And so it's not a uniqueness competition. It's not, you know, it's not about choosing a topic that no one else will have ever written about. Think about all the people who apply to college every year, Andrew. Probably all the topics have been taken, right? So everyone's written about a grandparent, everyone's written about their extracurricular, et cetera. So if it were a competition about uniqueness, I don't know, you know, it would be silly, for instance, to write about your toenails or something crazy like that, right? It's not a uniqueness competition. So you have to get away from that thinking, what's the most unique? You also have to get away from reading example after example after example and think, if I read enough examples, I'll know what to do. That's also not the case, right? So what you have to do is back up and say, what is it that I want the admissions committee to know about me? Okay. What qualities do I want them to walk away, you know, having read this essay? And then which of my personal or extracurricular slash professional experiences have best shown that? And that's when you start getting into these interesting, you know, figuring out these not only interesting topics, but delivering them in a compelling way, right? So let's say that you used to, I don't know, the deliberateness with which you walk your dog every morning. You know, it sounds like a silly example. I'm just giving an oddball example to talk about it. But maybe like you, you know, a certain time you wake up every day, you know, for, you know, there's a certain treat you give them and then the certain like leash you put on them, why you chose that leash when you're debating other leashes at that time and why you take them on a certain path or why you mix up the paths because there was a science article you once read so that, you know, to help you with your cognitive development, you always take different routes or something like that. Basically you start describing your methodical nature or how you use an evidence base for making certain decisions, even ones that are seemingly mundane. So now it's not a question about, it's not an essay about dog walking, right? It's an essay about you through the lens of dog walking. And so one of the big errors people make when they read an essay like that is they think, I want an essay like that. I want something as unique as dog walking. You miss the point if that's how you're thinking. Because so like there, you know, a few years ago, I'm not sure if you remember this, Andrew, Costco essay. Do you remember? Are you aware of this essay? Yeah. So I want to say about three admissions ago, some student, a very Costco essay. It was about their experience going through Costco, what they see in the different aisles and how those items and the way they go through Costco basically reflects who they are. And people like I, and so many parents started calling me and saying, can you help my kid write an essay like the Costco essay? I'm like, it's not about Costco. You know, we remember that because it's, you know, because it's out there. But it wasn't, because you can write a great essay about Costco. I can write a terrible essay about Costco, you know? So look, you know, it's sort of like missing the forest from the trees, right? So always think about, okay, what is it I want to communicate? If that student says, I want to communicate how methodical I am and how I approach everything in life deliberately, sometimes to a fault, because that adds richness to who you are as a person and shows humility and how you're self-aware. But then you think, you know, what are examples? Man, well, I was really obsessive about, you know, figuring out my dog walking routine in the morning. Great essay, because it's all about being methodical. I hope that helps clarify. And this is a topic I can talk about for hours and hours, but I hope that's a useful nugget.
Yeah, I think that's a helpful framework. And it sounds like figure out the message you want to convey, and then the actual examples that may not superficially be related to that, but they can be analogized in that way to demonstrate the qualities you want to communicate. Okay, so I know we're running up here on time. I just want to touch briefly a little bit on recommendation letters. What are your thoughts on who are the right kinds of faculty or other people who should be writing your letters, and what are the qualities that make for a standout recommendation letter? And if you could be very specific in terms of like the types of even like phrasing or wording, quantitative data points, even the comparisons that faculty make, what are the markers of a terrific recommendation letter, and who should they come from?
Yeah, sure. So number one, don't just go for people who are the highest ranking, right? Go for people who know really well, really like you, and have seen your achievement. Now, a lot of schools will say, well, we want two teacher letters, and then you can get a third letter, right? So if you're picking teachers, you know, people try to game this stuff. It should be from this department and all this. Yeah, of course, if you're applying for a science major, you should probably have one of the two be a science teacher or something like that. So obviously meet the requirements, make sure it aligns with, you know, your extracurricular background or your academic background. But beyond that, don't go for the biggest name necessarily. Like sometimes, like if your uncle knows a senator, it doesn't mean they should be writing your essay, your rec letter, if they don't know you very well. So going back to this idea, and I think the theme, like when we talk about extracurriculars, when we talk about essays, when we talk about rec letters too, think about what it is you want them to corroborate or what it is you want them to reinforce about. If you're, you know, going to this theme of being methodical, is there someone in your life, whether you're a science teacher or someone, you know, who observed you achieve at a high extracurricularly or in sports or something like that, who can talk about nature and how that helped you achieve things, and how, you know, they saw that you seem stubborn in time, but then when you broke through, man, there was like a method to this madness. And, you know, this student is just one of those students who, they will just work at it until they figure, they will experiment, they will pivot, they will do whatever it takes to figure it out. So it goes back to the qualities. And you want those people to touch on the similar qualities to the ones you're saying about yourself. The example I give here, Andrew, if I walk into a party, it's weird to say that right now with social distancing, but during normal times, I walk into a party and I say, hi, I'm Shidark. I'm really cool. You're going to love to get to know me. Everyone's going to think like, this guy's such a weirdo, right? Versus if you get along with people, you build good relationships, and other people say, man, he's really cool. That's going to resonate with people more than if you say it about yourself. So essays, you don't necessarily want to say I'm methodical. You have to demonstrate it. This is the show don't tell piece. With a rec letter, they can call you methodical. They can call you cool. So when requesting a rec letter, you might want to say, hi, you know, Mr. Yang, hope you're doing well. As you know, applying to colleges in the next few months. And, you know, I'm wondering if you would feel comfortable writing a strong letter of recommendation. I would especially value a letter from you because I think you can uniquely speak to X, Y, and Z. For instance, that time we worked on A, B, and C together. I'm working on my personal statement and my supplemental essays right now, and I would love to send you a draft when they're ready, just so you can see what message I'm intending to send. Is that something you would be open to? Regardless of what you decide, I'm so grateful that you considered this. You know, an email like that.
That's really good advice. One last question to wrap up. What are concrete actions students can take to cultivate the kind of faculty relationships that can result in great recommendation letters in a genuine way, not a transactional way?
Be a person. I don't know, is that cheesy, Andrew? You can check me on that. But essentially, don't just do things because they look for college. I think this is true for extracurriculars. It's true for rec letters, essays. Don't be like, I'm just going to do the thing that'll look the best. Then it's very transactional. Like, you only reach out to them when you need something. You only talk to them when you're in their class or something like that. Check in on them, see how they're doing. Stop by at recess, say hi after school. Like, how's your weekend or whatever? What are you doing this weekend? Be a person, show interest in people, because people who like you are far more likely to say wonderful things about you. And don't wait until you're 2 months out when you need something to ask, right? So approach it, build relationships with your teachers ahead of time, with your counselor ahead of time. Keep them posted on what you're doing. Maybe you took something in ninth grade, but then, there was something you guys talked about once after school and you started doing it over the summer. You come back in 10th grade, you say, Mrs. Robinson, like I did this thing and I just want to share it with you because we had talked about it. And just keep them posted on how things are going in your life. Ask about them, be a human being. And it's like cheesy, but age old advice.
Yeah, no, I think that that's great advice. And I think the key there is follow up and keep them apprised of your progress and status so they remain invested in you.
Absolutely.
All right, Chirag, thanks so much. I really enjoyed our chat again, as always. Where can listeners find out more about you, your work, your consulting services?
Yeah, sure. So, the site, shamassianconsulting.com, I can send you our, we have 100+ page guide on college admissions that really covers most of what you need to know in terms of extracurriculars, the timeline, rec letters, essays, and all this stuff. And I think that it'll be really valuable for folks to have access to that just to get, more of this framework for how to proceed. So I think that would be a really good starting place. But people are also always welcome to email contact@shamassianconsulting.com and we'll reply ASAP.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll definitely link to those in the show notes. I'll grab the 100-page guide from you and I'll definitely post a link to that as well. Thanks so much again for everything. I really enjoyed our chat and best of luck.
Likewise. Take care, Andrew. See you.
Cheers. Take care. All right, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed today's guest interview and got a lot of value and insights from it. If you like this episode, please hit that subscribe button to get new episodes automatically sent to you. Would love for you to not miss any episodes because the Hack Your Wealth podcast has a mix of action-packed solo shows where I walk you through specific strategies and tactics step by step, as well as guests who share their expertise about specific areas of personal finance, and finally profile interviews of business owners who are trying to turn their side hustles into fully financially self-sustaining passive income streams. We break down exactly what they do, how they do it, and how much they're earning. So be sure to subscribe so you don't miss any of that great content. Also, would love if you could help me out and take 30 seconds to go to Apple Podcasts and leave a podcast review. It helps to support this podcast and it helps other people who are looking for topics like this find the podcast. And I really appreciate it if you could take a minute and just leave an honest review. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Hack Your Wealth podcast with Andrew Chen. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes and check out hackyourwealth.com for all our latest content.